It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by on-camera and voiceover talent RodHunter.com and the law offices of Matthew Simone. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist Bob Siegel.
Say hello to my producer, Brendan Thomas.
Hello, Bob. How are we doing? I wanted to try to give you some questions about the Bible or questioning about Christianity in general. Now, personally, I want to point out that I am a Catholic person. I have grew up in a Catholic church, and I still celebrate that religion to this day. So in no way am I denouncing my religion by any means necessary. I just have interest in these questions.
But if I were to denounce it for you, you wouldn't get any. No. And you know I'm kidding, because yes. I'm not Catholic, but Protestant churches have their problems too, and I would take them on too. I'm not of the belief that any one church is completely reading the Bible, and that includes churches I go to.
So. Right. So in this case, I have a few different questions to ask. We might not get through them all, but we'll see where we go tonight.
Okay.
So very first question I wanted to point out to you is very simple. Is gambling a sin?
Okay. There's nothing in the Bible that says gambling is a sin, Brendan. However, the Bible says a lot about financial stewardship and the responsibility for our money and to be wise and make wise decisions. This may or may not relate to gambling. Let me put it this way. Let's say somebody was taking a trip to Reno or Las Vegas. They're on vacation, just like any family might budget for a vacation. So when people budget, they'll usually say, okay, for this vacation, we're going to spend this much money, maybe even this much extra money to stay in some really nice hotel instead of a Motel 6. We're going to really splurge for dinner. We're going to spend money for that. So by nature of a vacation and relaxation, you have money set aside to splurge anyway. We don't do it all the time. We shouldn't do it all the time. But once in a while, we've accepted as human beings that that is okay. So let's say somebody says, well, I'm going to get a kick out of playing poker, although I love playing poker with friends. I think only a fool would play poker in a professional casino.
Yeah.
however, sitting down at the blackjack table, you have a better chance of winning. I will say that. Here's the thing. If they say, okay, I'm going to budget $100 for gambling instead of the $100 I might have used to go to a nicer restaurant or nicer hotel. And if they can stick to that, then okay, if I lose this $100, I'm done. If I gain it back, I'll keep playing. But once I get to the point where I've lost that $100, that's all I budgeted, that's all I set aside, then I think it's fine. Now, I should say there's something really addictive about gambling, because I have not been to casinos often, but I've been at a table, a blackjack table. And even when you're losing, there's a real euphoria and excitement in the game. And I can see why. I used to always say, boy, these idiots, they're winning all this money. Why aren't they quitting while they're ahead? I finally understood, because you get excited in the moment. However, I have, the few times I've gone to places like that, been good about budgeting my money. I remember one time you kind of asked me this question. I didn't even know till I walked in today that you were going to ask me this. There was another time I was visiting a church here in San Diego. I was going to be their guest speaker that morning.
Mm-hmm.
And before the morning service, they invited me to sit in on a Sunday school class just to kill the time. It was a discussion-oriented Sunday school class. And one of the couples had gone off gambling over the weekend, and there was a big bugaboo about it. Mm-hmm. So somebody in class decided to put me on the spot, and they said, hey, Bob, we have a question for you. Is gambling a sin? I said, well, that all depends on whether you win or lose. So anyway, I hope that helps. And feel free to respond to any of these, if any of these answers are raising further questions.
No, I think that's a sufficient answer. I think overall what you're saying is, in general sense, it is not a sin. It doesn't say anywhere in the Bible, particularly if it is a sin or not. However, it is still an addiction, and you still should kick these addictions out of the way and really budget yourself.
Any addiction is a sin, and the Bible tells us to use wisdom, make wise decisions, to be good stewards of our money. So there are certainly things that could relate to gambling, but no, just on paper, just gambling in and of itself. It's like anything else. You hear me say this often. A hammer is a tool. I can use it to hammer nails, or I could use it to hit someone in the head. I'm using it to hit someone in the head. Using the hammer is a sin. I'm using it to hammer nails. Using the hammer is not a sin.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's go on to our next question then. This one's going to be really, I guess, analytical is the word I'm looking for. Where was Jesus for the 3 days between his death and his resurrection? Now, some interpret that he went to heaven, and then there's some also that also interpret some of the readings in the Bible saying that he went to hell as well. So I wanted to hear your interpretation and see where you think he went to, actually, between those 3 days.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And actually, he did not go to heaven. He went to kind of an in-between holding place. The Bible refers to this place as Hades. That's not the only word that they use for it. They also use the word prison. And this was the word that Peter used. And then there's another word that the Bible uses for hell that talks about the ultimate hell. I guess if we were to relate it to our prison system and our court system, somebody gets arrested, where do they go while they're awaiting trial? Well, where did they go before cities start canceling bail and stuff? They go to jail, awaiting their trial. And then after jail, they go to their trial. And then if they're found guilty, they'll go to prison. So the Bible talks about the kind of hell where people are awaiting trial and the kind of hell where people are finally going to be cast off. Now, within Hades, there's another section called Tartarus where disobedient angels went. And Peter, in both 1 Peter and 2 Peter, you put those together, we learn that where Jesus actually went is he went to this in-between prison, not because he needed to go there. Obviously, Jesus was the Son of God. He had paid for our sins, but that was all taken care of on the cross. He became separated from God the Father on the cross. That was all taken care of. But he had not yet resurrected. We go to heaven when we get resurrected. The resurrected Jesus then went into heaven. He went there and he actually spoke to angels that had been disobedient in the days of Noah. Now, for those of you listening and you don't believe in the Bible, I know it's going to sound like Greek mythology to you. What can I say? This is what the Bible tells us. There were angels in the days of Noah that disobeyed God, took on human form, and came down and actually had sexual relationships with women. And God intervened and did a bunch of things right away. First of all, he took those angels and he sent them to Tartarus, where Jesus went and visited them. The second thing he did is he destroyed their offspring, who were called the Nephilim. The Nephilim were kind of a half-human, half-angel offspring, and apparently were very evil and very evil influencers. He destroyed them. The third thing he did is he sent the flood. The flood obviously destroyed the Nephilim, but destroyed everybody else who had followed after them, everyone but Noah and his family. The disembodied spirits of the Nephilim are what the Bible called demons. But the parents of the demons, the angels, are there in hell. Peter says Jesus went and preached to them. Now, some people say, well, why? What's the point of preaching? Obviously, they're never going to repent. He went in there and apparently, the Bible doesn't give enough information, he apparently just proclaimed the victory that you've lost this battle, you are awaiting judgment. But after he was there during that in-between time, then he was raised from the dead, then he was here in this world for 40 days and 40 nights, and then he was caught up into heaven, and he's in heaven now, and he will return someday as the resurrected Jesus. So, boy, I know that that answer could...
It's a very
We could probably make 10 whole one-hour radio shows out of it. And folks, for those of you that like to say that the Bible was stolen from Greek mythology, I actually like Greek mythology. I don't believe in it. That's why I call it mythology. Mm-hmm. But the Old Testament predates Greek mythology. The New Testament doesn't, but a lot of what I just said came out of the Old Testament. And another book that, well, the Ethiopian church includes it in the Bible. Other churches do not. It's called the Book of Enoch. But Enoch is quoted by Jude, the brother of our Lord, who wrote the very short Book of Jude. And Peter is referring to the Book of Enoch in both 1st and 2nd Peter, where I was just going. So anyway, I do have a few podcasts where I get into that in a little more detail for those of you that want to study this further.
Okay, I'll take a look at those too, because I'm actually really interested in what you were talking about and just this 2 minute period.
Now, I should say, if you go to a place like Barnes and Noble, there'll be all kinds of books about where Jesus went. And many people have gotten rich writing books about the lost years of Jesus before the Gospels and the in between time when he died. But that's all that's happening. They're getting rich selling books. They don't have any actual factual information to give us, at least nothing that's coming out of the Bible.
True. I gotcha.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Bob Siegel not only writes fiction, but nonfiction as well. Over the years, Bob has received wonderful comments about his book on Christian apologetics entitled, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Many have put this book in the hands of their seeking, unbelieving friends, and the book takes it from there. This is because the book has a rhetorical skeptic that argues with Bob about the harder, less frequently discussed questions. As a result, the reader is immediately aware that they are reading from an author who relates to them. The moment they find themselves questioning something they see, their very question appears in the text. Every question in this book was one that was personally put to Bob during his many years of speaking on college campuses. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church.
Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? Why does the Bible call premarital sex a sin? How will God judge the people who never heard of Jesus? These are but some of the critical concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob Siegel tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book will be enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to talk about my latest book, The Many Myths About Ministry. As you know, I'm a Christian apologist, but let me tell you something. In my many years of interactions with skeptics, doubters, and even seekers, I have found that the vast majority of their problems with Christianity stem from previous church experiences. Yes, What's more, many of their concerns are valid and serve as inspiration for this book. While defending the truth of the Bible and the importance of the gospel message, I nevertheless take an honest look at the way Christians interact with each other. From the larger issues of putting our leaders on too high a pedestal, to the unfair judging of the way another person worships, to the unsolicited advice which claims to have been led by the Spirit of God. Of course, and I do believe the Spirit of God speaks, I do, but a lot of times Christians are putting words in his mouth. Who are we kidding? My friends, this simple, easy read will strike a chord of familiarity with anyone involved in church life. It's a call to lay aside the unimportant issues that distract us and return to the heart of Christian community.
The Many Myths About Ministry by Bob Siegel, available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
All right, so now to the next question I got. Don't worry, I want to point this out. I'm having a great time with my wife when I ask about this question here.
Right, Brendan? Yes, we have a special prize selected just for him. So, I say good show.
Thank you, thank you. The question is, what does the Bible say about divorce and remarriage exactly?
Well, finish your question.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I know in terms of in a historian fashion, King Henry VIII, I believe, back in the day, had so many different wives that he decided to create his own religion because basic Christianity says, no, that's a terrible...
The Pope would not grant the divorce of his first wife, Catherine, exactly, when he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn. And Henry had been a very devout Catholic up to that point, but he just said, well, what the heck, I'll be the head of the church. And yes, that was the creation of the Church of England.
That's right, yeah. So in its original form of the Bible, I'm assuming it says divorce and remarriage is null, basically. But maybe you might educate me on this, actually.
Yeah, well, and again, like I said at the top of our time in this segment, there are other churches that say things that I don't agree with either. It's very commonly taught, the church is getting better. It has been very commonly taught up to now that any kind of remarriage is not recognized by God. Is divorce a sin? Is remarriage a sin? Let's start with divorce. Divorce is not something that God prefers. Under most circumstances, it is a sin. There are extenuating circumstances, however. Jesus gave one of them. If your spouse commits adultery, you're free. The Apostle Paul gave another one. If your spouse just leaves you. And in those days, there were people who were hearing the gospel. One of them would accept Christ. The other one wouldn't. So you'd have a believer married to an unbeliever. Now, let me say this very carefully. Paul did not command Christians to leave their spouses just because they weren't Christians. But he did acknowledge that it was happening from the other side, that spouses that had not converted were leaving because they felt that their partner had become some kind of nutwig, and so they just left. And in those cases, Paul said, you are free. If you go to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the term that's used is loosed or bound, but he's talking about marriage. The New International Version, I like the way they translate it. He says, if you are divorced, he recommends that you don't remarry, but for other reasons. He went on in that chapter and he said, you know, and by the way, Paul had been married because you couldn't serve on the Jewish Sanhedrin without being married. He had been on the Sanhedrin, but this is many years later. And by the time he's writing to the Corinthians, he's not married anymore. Was he divorced? We don't know. Was he a widow? We don't know. We do know that he had lived as a married man. He's now living as a single man. And he's actually saying, if you're living as a single person, you might be able to serve God a little more freely. But he made it very clear that was just his opinion, just his preference. He says, you don't have to do that. So he says, are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you divorced? Do not seek to remarry. But then he quickly says, but if you do, you do not sin. So divorce is a sin if somebody says, you know, I know I took a marriage vow, but I met somebody hotter, or I'm tired of the vow, and they break it off for that reason, that is a sin. So in other words, the instigator of the divorce is the sinner. But okay, the person who's the recipient of it, if your spouse or my spouse or somebody else's spouse chose to leave them, the remaining party would be free to remarry.
Gotcha.
And yet within there, Paul's saying, but it would be nice if nobody got married, but I know a lot of you are going to do it anyway, so go ahead. And by the way, he was just one apostle. Peter was married. Peter traveled around with his wife. So you got to take that with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Paul himself tells you right in that chapter, take this with a grain of salt. He made it really clear there. Sometimes I get revelations from the Lord. With marriage, he was expressing his opinion. Only the part about recommending that people just live a single life, that he said was his opinion. The part about divorce being a sin or not being a sin, that part he had a direction from the Lord about.
Okay, I understand now. So just double check with you. The person who starts the divorce part, he's the person, or he or she is the one that's the sinner in this case.
The one that's breaking the vows, unless somebody broke the vows by, say, having an affair, and then the other person is divorcing them not to break the vow, but to just be free because they no longer feel obligated. A better way to put it is the person who breaks the vow. Either they just filed for divorce because they're tired of the person, or maybe they didn't file for divorce, but they just went and broke the vow in some other way. That's the guilty party. Now,
okay,
some people listening, maybe you've filed for a divorce, or you've had an affair, maybe you've done a lot of those things. We always need to go back to the fact that the message of the gospel is forgiveness. We've all sinned. So if you're listening and your marriage is broken up, maybe you were the culprit, you can still get a fresh start. So calling something a sin is not the same as calling you at a point of no return. We want to be very clear about that.
Okay. Well, we're coming near the end of the show, so I'll just stick it off with one more question here. Who was Cain's wife? Now, in Genesis, we are described about Cain himself, but his wife is still kind of not really said in the Bible. Some say that it's a sister, possibly, or a family member. Now, it's a different time entirely back then, obviously, so we view it differently, but do you have an interpretation on who Cain's wife was in the Bible by any chance?
Well, that's a big mystery to a lot of people, and not just who his wife was. When Cain killed his brother Abel and then God banished him, Cain was afraid of running into a bunch of people who might hurt him, and God, in his mercy, put a protective mark on him. So if Cain was the first child born to Adam and Eve, Abel was the second, and Abel's now dead. Not only do we ask the question, where did Cain's wife come from? But who are all these other people that Cain's afraid of running into? I believe myself, Brendan, that it was not just Adam and Eve living in the garden, but there was a whole community of people. Now, Adam and Eve, I do believe, were the first human beings.
Oh, I agree. I agree on that.
The command to be fruitful and multiply was given while they were in the garden. You see, it takes us only 2 or 3 minutes to read the first chapters of Genesis. Sometimes that deludes us into thinking that Adam and Eve were only in the garden for 2 to 3 minutes. Remember, they were immortal. They were living in eternity. They were experiencing then what heaven will be for us someday, the resurrection, body, soul, and spirit. That's a return to that. And I believe they obeyed that command. They were fruitful and multiplied. And I believe a whole race of people was banished from the Garden of Eden. Now, some people say, yeah, but Bob, it says that Cain was Eve's first child. No, the word Cain means with the Lord's help, I have had a child. The curse upon Adam and Eve, part of that curse was that women were going to have pain in childbearing. That doesn't mean they were having pain in childbearing before. After they sinned, I believe Cain is listed as Eve's first child born in pain. There were many other people, any one of which could have been his wife. All right, these were great questions, Brendan, and feel free anytime. I love talking about the Bible. I love taking Bible questions. And ladies and gentlemen, we will see you next time.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the Law Offices of Matthew Simone.